My guest, Monica De La Torre, is a poet, essayist, translator, editor, and teacher. De La Torre was raised in Mexico City, and after studying political science at university, moved to New York, where she received an MFA in writing, and later a PhD in Latin American and Iberian cultures at Columbia University. During this time, she also worked as a senior editor at BOM magazine. In addition to publishing 7 volumes of poetry, De La Torre has translated multiple works from Spanish to English and vice versa. She's co-edited an anthology of contemporary Mexican poetry, and most recently, she co-edited a long overdue and very welcome anthology, Women in Concrete Poetry, 1959 to 1979. At the same time, she's kept up a prodigious output of essays and interviews. De La Torre's writing is notable for its ambition, curiosity, restlessness, and humor, and for creating a sometimes vertiginous space in which one feels on the verge of grasping something ineffable at the same time as it remains tantalizingly out of reach. Monica, you said, "I've never been interested in committing to a single mode of literary output or in finding a voice or style that's recognized as my own. I'm more interested in exploring multiple modes than in pledging allegiance to one of them. I'm as skeptical of dogma as I am of branding." What's the appeal for you, Monica, of multiplicity, and what specifically are you skeptical of when it comes to a singular perspective or voice?
I was thinking of John Cage, for instance, who also is about multiplicity, simultaneity, interpenetration. All these values produce different works, but are shared by all the works. So perhaps in my writing, the way in which a particular project manifests might appear to be very different from how it manifests in other books or other projects, but ultimately all the work shares similar values, and those values are the constant in the work.
And how would you describe those values?
Whenever, in fact, I recognize something that I've done before that I'm starting to get a little comfortable with, I almost boycott it. I thwart myself because I don't want to go in that same direction. So that's one of them. Another value that I think is very present in a lot of what I do is a desire to never take myself too seriously. So whenever I start sensing that I'm taking something too seriously, I also will stop myself and make sure that there's something in the writing that will counterbalance the self-seriousness or undermine it. Maybe it will have like a self-deflating effect on the writing, and that's certainly intentional. And also just like the ability for the writing to hold multiple points of view.
What you just said is quite interesting, that there's a conscious self-deflating aspect of your work. I don't know if I would say it's unusual, but there are a lot of artists and writers who do just the opposite. They puff themselves up. So what's behind the impulse to self-deflate?
I wish I had a very solid answer for that. I can say that pomposity and heroism, I have an innate allergy to all that stuff, but also it just seems completely misplaced. I do think that there's a comedy to what we do as writers. I'll just speak for myself. Being a poet in the 21st century is absurd. It's comedic, even if you take yourself very seriously. That's something that informs everything I do, that the comedy of my doing this, when really the pressures to be a more active member of society, to contribute more to society, those pressures are significant. And yet, often, the only thing I can find myself doing is writing something that may or may not have readers or any impact on anything, really. So that's a little bit what largely informs my position when it comes to writing. And that's not to say that I don't believe that writing can be transcendent or it can't soar and achieve goals that are incredibly worthy, but underneath, there's always the slight comedy of the mismatched aspirations and ambitions one might have with the actual role that they occupy in society.
You've said, and I think you touched on this just now, you've said that you try and avoid being too present in your work, and you've cited that as a political choice. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. In what way is the concealing of the self a political decision?
I'm skeptical of confessionalism, for instance, and any writing that's too predicated on self-mythologizing, because ultimately, I personally don't think I'm that interesting or that special. I am more interested in being a catalyst for the reader, and now this is going to get really self-serious and ambitious and perhaps grand, but being a catalyst for the reader to have an experience of their own, where they're not trying to decipher me. It's not about what I can disclose or what epiphany I can reveal to the reader, but it's about involving them in such a way that they discover something about themselves more than about me. But I have to be careful, and I am careful, because I don't mean to say that I don't enjoy writing that does that when it's done in particularly interesting ways. I do think that there is an enormous amount of value in exploring one's subjectivity. It's just not my cup of tea when it comes to my own writing, because again, I just don't think I'm that exceptional. I'm also just constantly stimulated by the outside world.
Well, let's digress briefly from your work to the work of another writer. Let's hear about the first book on your list.
The first book on my list is by Julio Cortázar, called Historias de Cronopios y de Famas. And it was translated as Cronopios and Famas by Paul Blackburn, and it's published by New Directions. This little book is magnificent, and it's also a perfect illustration of what I'm trying to express. It's the first book in Spanish I remember falling in love with. Not the first book in English, because I had a professor of English literature that, or a number of professors actually of English literature that were really, really good teachers. Whereas the Spanish language ones tended to be a little too much about the canon and reading ways and normative ways. And I always resisted that. But I had a professor in, I guess, late middle school, early high school down there that nomenclature for years is different. So I think I was like 14 years old or maybe 15 when I read this book. And it's hilarious. It's not Cortázar's best book. And I bet a lot of people in the Spanish speaking world, if you ask them to name a book that meant a lot to them, they would have chosen Rayuela, Hopscotch, because that's kind of like the cliche of the book that changes your perception of what literature can do. But this little book that is not that ambitious, I've read it described as being a book of pataphysics, which I was not aware of at the time at all. And so it was very interesting to me to discover now that this book had an involvement with that tradition of the absurd, because to me, those worlds don't necessarily intersect. This book has multiple sections, and one of the sections is, the first one is an instruction manual. And it's very brief pieces that read as instructions that could be fiction, could be poetry. They also sometimes read like poetry. And they have the most absurd and delightful instructions to do things that, of course, are completely familiar and need no explanation. One of them is instructions on how to cry, instructions on how to wind your clock or your watch, instructions on how to climb a staircase. The humor, the language, to put it in academic jargon, the defamiliarization that these instructions perform is just absolutely amazing for me. And to go back to what I was saying before, they do act like little catalysts, because they're not about Cortázar. They're not about oneself. They're not about deep emotion or epiphanies. They're about the most banal things, but they manage to transform those banal things into absurd and miraculous rituals. And the text itself immediately captures the reader's imagination, because it's read in this way that applies to you, right? You feel that the instructions are talking to you as a reader. They're meant for you, and they are. They're not presenting you with something outside of themselves. They're like speech acts, which is also really interesting to me, because I realize that a lot of the writing that I like is in that liminal zone that doesn't map out with reality one-to-one. So on the one hand, it's completely banal and everyday, but on the other hand, they exist as possibilities or virtualities by the fact that they're instructions.
Why do you think your Spanish literature professor presented your class with this book? And did it have a similar impact, do you think, on your fellow students? Because my guess is you've said that it was very different from the other Spanish literature that you had been reading.
Well, on the one hand, the humor is just mordant. It's very present, but it's also importantly not one note. And I'll get to that in a second. Some of them by themselves might seem like one-liners to a degree, but then when you put them together with the other pieces in the book, they start acquiring these very dark undertones. So I think the professor, rightly so, wanted us to examine our own assumptions about what the texts or these little texts were doing. It really kind of sharpens your critical skills because you give in to the text, but then you have to resist what the text is saying. So I think that's perhaps one of the reasons why this was taught. Also, just because it really is, it's like radically accessible. So you enter this world and you let your guard down, and then you realize that what Cortázar is doing has very disturbing implications. So on the one hand, you have these instructions, and then the second part of the book has these hilarious accounts of the narrator's family. And the narrator keeps changing. So in some instances, it could be the same narrator, but in some instances, the narrator could be different. And so the speech act, the telling of the story of the family, gives rise or delineates a very different subject. So for instance, there's one speaker who's talking about what his family likes to do, and they like to do useless things, he says. And they just like delight in making things and having projects together. And so they decide to build a patíbulo, and a patíbulo in English is a gallows. So they build gallows, and they're building gallows on their front porch or the front yard. And the neighbors start realizing this, and they start congregating, and they bring the police. And so the neighbors are outraged, and the family's just delighting in building this thing. And of course, it's Argentina in the 60s. You're seeing this audience observing the family, on the one hand, wanting violence, and on the other hand, they want to see what the family, who they'll hang. But on the other hand, they're also outraged. And it's just like this very disturbing text in which no violence is committed, but you see it from the perspective of this person who thinks he's totally innocent and is making no excuses. It's totally matter of fact. So that same logic of the everyday then becomes perversely loaded in the second part of the book. I think the professor very intelligently wanted to bring us to the class these texts that theoretically have nothing to do with each other and are so disparate and so different. But then when you put them together, you start realizing, this is about dictatorships, fascism, and the banality of evil.
Monica, speaking about your book, The Happy End or Welcome, you said, so ultimately then I find myself at Kippenberger's installation at MoMA, and I just go, wouldn't it be fun to write the dialogues that take place in all these settings Martin Kippenberger provided? And then many, many years later, I feel like, oh God, why did I ever want to do this and actually follow through with it? I'm curious here about your process. How long is there, for instance, between you having an idea and realizing it? And what happened in this case as you worked? Why did you feel some regret, even if only in a joking way, about undertaking that project?
I really like a definition of the Ulipo that goes something like, Ulipians are rats trying to escape the maze they built themselves.
Yeah, that's great.
That would be me too. Often in my process, I initially don't necessarily know where something is going. I'll just have an intuition and I follow it. And then at some point early on, I realize that if I take that thing further, it could become this other thing. And that's where I get myself into trouble, because there's a moment in which the larger idea for the structure of a piece or the main premise, the conceptual premise of a piece appears, and it supersedes the very small efforts I've made toward it. And so when that larger structure appears, then it becomes the cage, which I enter gladly, because of course, I always want to know what I'm doing. Unfortunately, I'm not the type of poet who's very intuitive and just like writes poems and then figures out how they all connect. I begin with something, then I see where it could lead, then I come up with the structure, the premise of the thing, and then that thing determines everything else. That process of then executing the idea that I've laid out for myself, that becomes a bit of a trap. But of course, the irony is that nobody has asked me to do that. I don't have to do it. And I could just like bend the rules or just ditch the thing if it's not working for me. But that's the way in which I challenge myself. So then I just have to follow it through completion.
How often you ditch projects?
I rarely do for that reason. The challenge is like, you thought this was a good idea? Well, now do it. Now you have to execute it. And even if I really don't want to do it, then it's like, well, that's great that you're resisting it, because then that means that this is really challenging and that's where you should go. You see?
Yes. Is there pleasure?
For me, pleasure comes very early on, and then it comes once I've passed midpoint, once I'm closer to the end, once I've completed something past the middle. And of course, sometimes I can't know where I am, but once I see the finish line, then it becomes really pleasurable. But it's when I'm stuck in the middle, then it's like really, really, really unpleasant. And that's when I make comments like the one I made in that interview, which is, what the hell was I thinking? I did change that challenge, for instance. So with the happy end, at first I thought I would try to write a dialogue for each one of the little settings that he has in the installation. And by setting, I mean an arrangement of a table or a desk and two chairs in which the interviews conducted by the members of the Nature Theater of Oklahoma at the end of Kafka's America are actually holding interviews. So he imagines these settings, and then he makes this installation that is very, very, very large. Importantly, it can never be taken in at one glance. You have to walk through it, and your experience of walking through it changes your perception of the rest of the installation. So that is the thing that allowed me to change course at some point and go, perhaps I don't need to write one dialogue per arrangement, because it's impossible to see all of them. He was after the experience of forgetting what you just saw or seeing it from a different angle and never having a complete picture. So that never having a complete picture is what allowed me to just at some point ditch the premise and just use chairs and settings that I was bringing into the installation, but that weren't necessarily there. So in other words, there's no one-to-one correspondence between the dialogues in my book and the settings that he has. In some cases there is, but in a lot of them there isn't.
The happy end strikes me as a hugely ambitious, anarchic, subversive book, one that posits a kind of alternative reality that sits right next to what we consider to be the everyday. I wonder if subversion is at the heart of your endeavor. And if so, where does this impulse come from? And what is it specifically that you're reacting against?
Yes, absolutely. I think the subversion is actually quite directed at language and how language bolsters certain power structures and power dynamics. In positions of authority, all kinds of authority, political authority, familial authority, work relations, etc., those in power want to create monologic discourses. They want to say things that are not questioned, right? They speak with the logic of there being one truth that cannot be contested. And so I find poetry in particular, but also fiction and writing in general, to be the prime arena in which those falsehoods, ultimately, because language does not work that way, writing is the ultimate arena in which those falsehoods can be contested. And so the subversion is precisely to take the same language that is being used to control people and to subject people to authority and expose its flaws and its holes and the loopholes in it. That's a really marvelous thing that just language allows for, because you take anything and it can always mean what the person issuing or emitting the monologic statement doesn't want it to mean. So that's ultimately, I think, what plays out quite consistently, actually, in The Happy End.
Monica, let's hear about the second book on your list.
So the second book in the list is this absolute gem of a book, Trilce by Cesar Vallejo. It was published in 1922, and it is a book of poems that, speaking of subversion, what Vallejo does with the Spanish language in this book is just miraculous, unsurpassed. He really kind of manages to speak a language that's all his own, and then at the same time, write poems that are extremely moving, that speak a language common to all of us. The way he expresses the manner in which the most private and intimate of feelings might feel to oneself. And they feel so extremely personal that one has the illusion that perhaps nobody can ever understand what this feels like because it's so personal. So he manages to mark language in such a way that it really feels extremely personal, but at the same time, we can relate to the way in which we feel that. And so it's an experience that feels at the limit of language, at the limit of the sayable. What's really brilliant about this book is not only its experimentation in those terms, he's using a lot of modernist techniques. There's absurdity, there's the very graphic sensibility that's bending alphabetical writing and seeing it as images as well. So there's like the seeds of the concrete approach to language. But he's also then writing poems that are about his family and that are about nostalgia and grief and mourning at not being a child anymore, not being in a space of play and intimacy with one's family members. And those poems are very accessible and they speak a language that's very familiar. So my theory about what he manages to do there is that when he needs to bring the reader in and create a collective space, he does that brilliantly. And then he also captures its opposite, the flip side of that, which is extreme alienation and how that alienation manifests in this language that is at the verge of being completely incomprehensible. It's a book that I keep returning to because it's inexhaustible. This is a book that I'll be reading when I'm 100 years old, if I ever get to be 100 years old, and I will still not understand half of it. And that's what I love about it. It just resists being paraphrased. Like, you can't paraphrase this book.
If I'm not mistaken, he was in prison when he began that book. Is that right?
Yes, he was in prison for something minor. It was like some
political thing.
Yes, but it wasn't any heroic political move. I think it was just like a kerfuffle he had with someone. It also involved an unwanted pregnancy, an affair. And yes, he was in prison. He's writing about confinement too, about being surrounded by four walls in a cell. And there's a poem dealing with that. But the poem, talk about complete subversion in language in terms of what he's able to do with Spanish language, like a syncretic blend between that and regionalisms that are very specific to Peru. An archaic language. That first poem in the book, there's at least five different theories about what it's about. And critics love coming up with their alternate interpretations of the poem. But the one that seems to be relied on because it's a firsthand account by a friend of his, Juan Espejo, is that he's basically taking a shit outside and the guards are seeing him. They're monitoring him. He's comparing his own excrement to guano and then writing about guano in a beautiful book. Yeah, trilce itself, the name, is such a beautiful word, and it's a neologism, right? Trilce does not exist. Trilce is trilce. Trilce is Cesar Vallejo's world. Apparently also the result of a typo.
Oh, really?
Yes. The book was going to have the most abominable title. It was going to be called Los Cráneos de Bronce, The Bronze Skulls. Now, if this gem of a book was called that, I doubt very much that it would have become a modernist classic, The Bronze Skulls, Los Cráneos de Bronce. But so because of that typo on the cover, he came up with Trilce, which might be a combination between sweet and sad, triste y dulce, the allusion to three. The book has a lot of trinities. He was also a very Catholic poet in the sense that like Catholicism was really seeped into his imagination. But the thing that is important to me is that we tend to think of those unquestioned canonical figures such as Cesar Vallejo as like these geniuses that never made mistakes or that just had this vision that was crystal clear to everybody always, right? And the fact that Cesar Vallejo would title his book Los Cráneos de Bronce is just marvelous. It proves that you work at it. It doesn't always come to you. And even someone like Vallejo could be very sappy and write exquisite poems and at the same time make a blunder like that title.
I'm interested in the subversion of language in relation to your work also, because you grew up in Mexico in an era when the pre-dominated Mexican politics, and you've spoken about the way that they used language, and you've actually described their use of language as perverse and masterful. What was perverse and masterful about it? And how much do you think that experience for you was formative?
Completely formative, yes. What was perverse was not unlike Trump, the PRI would co-opt anything that was said against it. They would take criticisms leveled against them, co-opt them, turning that thing into something completely different than what it was originally intended. They muddled things in such a clear-cut way that people wouldn't even understand that they were muddled. Just the name of the party itself is, it's not Trumpian, it's more Kafkian, which is the name of the party itself is the Partido de la Revolución Institucional, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the Party of the Institutionalized Revolution. You can't have a revolution that becomes an institution.
Very oxymoronic.
Exactly. Those two things do not correspond. It's an oxymoron.
Were you aware that they were doing that when you were young?
Yes, I was. The perversity of it is that it invariably neutralizes the opposition or stumps it.
And that's the mastery as well, because it's so hard to counter.
Yes, because you're left without tools. When the language you would use to counter something is co-opted, then you have to invent something else, which then again gets co-opted.
For you, I think that was very much where your sense of humor was cultivated, perhaps.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Because humor, as it plays out, it points to the holes in language. There's a contestation, there's a critique that gets co-opted. And then when you use that language and just ape it and say it back to the system, then the humor is produced, right? And you subvert the order of things. But you know, actually, I'm thinking of someone who did this so beautifully. Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz was this Baroque nun who had an exquisite intelligence. You read her analysis of how gender dynamics played out back then, and still they seem spot on and way ahead everybody else's. That dazzles me. So she has this very famous poem in which she says, hombres necios que acusáis a la mujer de ser aquello que ustedes, I'm not quoting it properly, but hombres necios que acusáis a la mujer. So it's like, you stubborn men who accuse women of being the very thing that you've created. A great example of that would be Lady Macbeth, who's accused of being the seductress, the perverse, evil, ambitious force behind Macbeth. But we forget that Lady Macbeth was created by a man. So then she's blamed for the thing that she was written to be, as if she were the very manifestation of female evil, but she was written by a man. She's a projection. Sor Juana's poems always pointed to that contradiction really brilliantly.
Your dad is Mexican, your mother is American, and you've said that growing up, this left you feeling that you'd never fit in and that normality was not normal. What was it that made you feel like an outsider? And what was normal for you and your family if it wasn't the same as the families that you were seeing around you?
Because my mother and father came from such radically different backgrounds, even though both families are still very Catholic, but their backgrounds are so different and their experiences of life are also so radically different. Growing up in my family always pointed to the fact that there was a lot of incongruity. So you might think that things are one way, but they're never just one way. And we had a constant reminder of that.
Can you give an example?
Maybe this is really convoluted, but I'm going to give it a whirl and see where it goes. Say in the family structure, my father is the patriarch. So he's in a position of total authority. We're growing up in Mexico. He's macho in a kind of awesome way, but macho nonetheless. And very much into his position of authority. But he's not only that, because if I saw my father from the point of view of my mother's family in the US, my father was a kind of marginal dude. He was not in a position of authority. He was this Mexican. So my father then becomes both the symbol of power within our family in Mexico, but then he's also the symbol of the outcast, of the minority, of the guy with no power. He's this Mexican.
So he's undermined. Very interesting.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So he plays those two roles at the same time. And conversely with my mother, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, but in particular in the 80s, which is when my political consciousness was much more developed, right? So in the 80s, I realized Americans are really nasty people. Not every American, but the role that America has played in Latin America is grotesque. It's outrageous. And the people I hang out with, even though I'm in a school called the Modern American School, and it was bilingual, and it was There were a lot of expats there, and it espoused a lot of American values. Intellectually minded people and critical people were very critical of the United States. So my mom has this ambiguous role where she's this gorgeous blonde, American blonde, that's very desirable. Wherever we went, people would look at her in Mexico. But at the same time, politically, she has this other valence. She's this gringa. So she's two things at once and two radically different things at once. So she isn't that, but she stands for those two radically different things in people's imaginations. So that's kind of what I mean. Nothing was ever just one thing. Nothing was ever stable. This sounds very binary, but I think a lot of the things I experienced in life had this double meaning.
Yeah, very interesting. Really, really interesting. Monica, let's hear about the next book on your list, the third one.
Oh, this book is incredible. Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo. So interesting that we're talking about my father and the patriarchy, because this book is all about a father figure and the figure of the uber father figure in Mexican culture, which is the cacique. So this book begins with a beautiful line that anyone who studied Mexican literature at any point will remember, which is, vine a Comala porque me dijeron que aquí está mi padre. I came to Comala. Comala is this invented town. I came to Comala because they told me my father was here. Already in that sentence, you, the reader, are also in Comala. You're inhabiting that same space, and he's talking to you. There's no presentation in the book. Like, everything is direct speech. There's no narration. Everything that happens in this book is said by this character or other characters. So it's kind of like a theater of voices. It's almost ethnographic in the sense that Juan Rulfo had the most exquisite ear for Mexican regionalisms. So it's as if you're actually hearing the people in the book say and speak in ways in which actual Mexicans speak. In the middle of this book, you realize that Comala is a wasteland. Actually, there's been writing about comparing this wasteland, Comala, the town, with T.S. Eliot's wasteland. There's nothing there. Everybody's dead. It's a ruin of a town. And the only thing that remains is the ghosts of the people that this man, the narrator's father, the people that he's oppressed and abused, women and children. And so caciques owned a lot of land. They had indigenous people working for their land. And they were these very powerful people that were very problematic for central authorities because they had so much power over their own region. And wars used to happen between caciques. So what you realize in this book is that every person that the narrator speaks to is either the child of Pedro Páramo or a woman who has something to do with Pedro Páramo. Does that make sense? Did I explain it correctly?
So it sounds like they were fiefdoms, actually.
Yeah, they had fiefdoms, exactly. That's what it was. So they owned the land. Everybody in the land worked for them, and they would just sleep with all the women in the land. And so in the book, the premise is that every single male that the narrator comes across is also the child of Pedro Páramo. The way in which this reality is conveyed is incredibly poetic. It's never overdetermined. It speaks to Mexican power structures, really, and the PRI and everything that came after the revolution. Also, another thing that is important about the book, it's very slim. It's under 100 pages. There's no chapters or anything. It's just almost like a transcription, say, a transcription of the voices of the dead in this wasteland, in this ghost town. But it used to be much, 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 much longer, and it wasn't operating the same way. So it did have description, it had presentation of different settings, etc. So voices weren't doing all the work. But the author, Juan Rulfo, who was from Guadalajara, from the Jalisco region of Mexico, worked with this poet, Alichu Macero. And Alichu Macero edited the book with Juan Rulfo. The classic that we know is a result of this brutal edit on the part of Chumacero, who cut 2/3 of the book.
Which is also a bit like The Wasteland, right?
Exactly. A lot like The Wasteland, yes. What Chumacero gave it was the structure of this poorly delivered poem in which fiction is implied. The fiction of the book is implied in what the people are saying, but it's never told to you. I just love the immediacy of that method. It's one that informed, say, García Márquez, who claimed to have known this book by heart. He memorized this book, and the book follows a structure that then García Márquez incorporates into Chronicle of a Death Foretold.
When you were two, Monica, you were in a terrible car accident. And years later, you discovered that the injury you sustained in the crash had caused severe scoliosis of the spine. And the doctors told you you could avoid surgery or perhaps avoid surgery if you wore a back brace, which you did for almost 4 years from the age of 13 to 17. You did that almost 24 hours a day. Writing about this, you've said, some of my classmates developed eating disorders in order to fit into Jordache jeans, while I tried to fit a little wedge into my left shoe and become one with my orthopedic device. An ordeal like this would be enormously challenging for anyone, but for a teenager, it must have been hugely difficult, particularly difficult. How did you manage that ordeal?
By being extremely single-minded, not thinking of the larger picture, I was just like, okay, this is a challenge that has been presented to me and I have to overcome it. And I will just overcome it on a daily basis by doing little things that take my mind off it. Really. On the one hand, like an extreme focus on the small challenges, for instance, of wearing that wedge in my shoes so that my legs would be even. And the clothes I had to wear were two sizes bigger than my actual size because the clothes had to accommodate that back brace. And so just thinking about what I could wear to conceal the back brace, focusing on what kinds of things I could do, what kinds of things I couldn't do, that kind of replaced the bigger concerns. But then on the other hand, I also kind of dissociated and pretended like it really wasn't happening or it wasn't that bad. Maybe this is also something that happens with adolescence. Sometimes you just get so caught up in what you're experiencing in the moment that you don't think about the larger implications of things. So that was a blessing.
Many adolescents would feel that. And being so obviously different from the other kids in school or one's friends would, I think, make many people feel very sorry for themselves in that situation. It sounds like you didn't do that, which is remarkable.
Yeah, I didn't do that. Maybe I should have done it a little bit just so I would have processed what was going on. But, you know, it would have been helpful. I don't know where I gathered the tools to deal with it. One thing that I didn't mention about the Cortázar book is that when I was describing those pieces about families, some of them are really funny and they're about gregariousness and world building between family members. When I think of that, I think of it as very joyous and nurturing and supportive. So my family was extremely gregarious in Mexico. I had three brothers and sisters. So there's four of us in total. All of them had a lot of friends. The house was always full of people. There was no privacy, really, which was a problem because I wanted to write. There was no privacy whatsoever. But the fact that there was always so much going on, it was almost like a permanent party. And my parents, too. My dad loved being with his friends and doing things and having people over. So I think that also was a big help for me. I was always playing a particular role within these dynamics that were very peopled and full of humor and surprises and the unexpected and stuff. So that really helped me. So in other words, if I had undergone this situation, say, maybe in the United States, it would have been different because there's so much more emphasis on the individual. People are more isolated. I always thought of myself as someone who clearly was an individual, but I always thought of myself in relation to all these other people. So also, I had school friends who were very gregarious as well. I would always be at their house. They would come over. So by those closest to me, I was never made to feel different. And maybe that also helped. It's something that I never thought of. But now talking with you, I realize it was an enormous help. No one ever singled me out.
You've also said that wearing the brace made you feel freakish, but that you, and then this is a quote, quickly discovered that embracing freakdom could be hugely liberating. It reminds me a little bit of something Deanne Arbus said when she was photographing the people that she described as freaks. She said, most people go through life dreading they'll have a traumatic experience. Freaks were born with their trauma. They've already passed their test in life. They're aristocrats. And it seems to me that that was a test for you, and you found a way to be liberated through that test.
Yes, absolutely. I love that quote. I didn't know it. It captures perhaps the root of my stoicism, which I also had. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know that I was different from anybody else. I just felt like, yeah, this is pretty bad, but at least I know what it is. And this will prepare me for other really bad experiences in life, you know? Yeah, I would tell myself this. Like, if this is the worst that can happen and I'm already surviving it, then nothing can be that bad.
And then sadly, you did have to have the surgery after almost 4 years of the brace.
Yes, I did. It's funny because speaking of things that have opened up multiple possibilities, like I never thought that it was an option not to wear the brace. I always felt like I had to do it and I had to try it out, regardless of whether the possibility that it failed would actually come to materialize. I have a friend, Suzanne Bocanegra, who also had a back brace when she was a teenager. She had it very briefly. She was told the same thing I was told, which is it might fail, but do you want to give it a try and see if you can avoid surgery later on? And she was like, absolutely not. I want to get the surgery. And so she got the surgery right away. And that was like, oh, I guess we could have done that. You know, we could have just gotten it over and done with early on. It was another thing that reinforced my sense of the absurd.
Time for another book, the fourth one.
Yes. The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño. I realized that a lot of the books on my list are somewhat related to poetry, but are not necessarily poetry, with the exception of Trilce by Vallejo.
And Stein.
And Stein, of course. But even Tender Buttons by Stein, these are prose poems, and they don't look like traditional poems, right? And of course, Jack Spicer's After Lorca. I guess what I mean is that they have a relationship to fiction. Maybe that's what I should say. All the books in my list that is interesting in relation to The Savage Detectives by Bolaño. What draws me to this book is, on the one hand, the fact that the lead protagonists of the book are poets. They're looking for this avant-garde woman writer who's gone missing. There's very few traces of her writing. But they're all poets whose writing you never see in the novel. Everything that happens in the novel, you gather from what the characters are saying. And I realize that this keeps coming up, my choices of books. There's no omniscient narrator. Everybody has their own version of accounts. And they're being asked by someone else, and you never quite know exactly who's doing the asking and what these people are being asked. But everything they say is so convincingly of a time period in Mexico City. Like, I can see these characters just from what they say. Like, they're completely believable to me in terms of their speech patterns, their accounts, the anecdotes. They all gather at the National University at UNAM, the literature department there. And it's a place where I wanted to study, but I didn't study because when I graduated from high school, it was on strike. It was on strike for a couple of years. But it was a hotbed of poets and fiction writers and intellectuals. And I just love the way Bolaño depicts that culture. It very much matches my experience of being a young adult in Mexico City and having the city be your playground in a way. Mexico City was a great place to be a young adult. I guess it's not unlike New York City, but it just has all these layers. Nothing is ever boring. You just keep uncovering new aspects of the city, new neighborhoods, new people. It's just mind-boggling. It has nothing to do with acquisition power or wealth. The most transcendent experiences are just miraculous and free. And all you need to do is just put yourself out there and open your eyes and experience things. So what I love about this book is everything is poetic in the book. And yet poetry is absent, but it's so much more charged with poetry because you never see the poem. You never see the poems. Therefore, you can't judge them. You can't take them down. You can't contest them. It's just like poetry is everywhere, and poetry mainly is in Mexico City. And this book is like a love letter to Mexico City, which is also what I absolutely adore. Yeah. And the fact that you could write a novel that was successful and that would mean so much to so many different people about these low-life poets is just astonishing to me.
At what age, Monica, did your parents give you free run of the city?
Well, they didn't have to do that necessarily because I was kind of sneaky. I would do a lot of things without permission with my friends. I'll say this. I could drive when I was 16. So already having a car, I didn't have my car, but there was a car that me and my siblings could use. So that car made a lot of things possible. What I realized early on is that the best adventures always happen on weeknights, on school nights. So that's when we would run wild and go to really cool places. Tuesdays were particularly good, Tuesdays and Wednesdays.
I'll keep that in mind next time I go to Mexico City.
Yeah.
I want to go back in time a little bit, because there was a time in your childhood, I'm not sure exactly when you aspired to be a nun. And I'm curious what drew you to this, and when and why you decided that that wasn't going to be your path.
Well, I think it had something to do with Sor Juana. By current standards, people always wondered about her sexuality. It's been said that perhaps she was lesbian. You could read a lot of poems of hers as lesbian love poems. That read holds. So it's very possible. But whatever the situation was, you could say she didn't want to conform to traditional women's roles. That's what I felt. I didn't want to be a housewife. When I fantasized with being a nun, I was maybe 13. This is before I had my brace, actually. When I got my brace, things changed. I became very rebellious. But right before I got the brace, I really enjoyed going to church because of the ritual aspect of it and song. I was in the chorus of the church, and I loved singing in this Sunday ritual that felt purifying and cleansing and just transcendent, not every day. This was not something I thought I would do for a very long time. I did feel like I could become a nun, and it was a way out of having my early adulthood be about finding a husband, marrying well, having children, all that stuff. I rejected it. So the way out and the way in which I could actually devote myself to intellectual pursuits without having to worry about people getting on my case or anything was through, being a nun. Ha! Little did I know.
I'm thinking about your comment a second ago that after you were in the brace, you became very rebellious. And I want to ask you about that in a second. But it seems to me that aspiring to be a nun in some families could in and of itself be an act of rebellion.
Yes. And it's possible that that was also something I was subconsciously thinking about. Yeah, it was rebelling against what I thought society wanted of me.
So how did your parents deal with your later rebellion when you were in the brace? And what form did it take?
Well, I was always really good. I was a very, very good kid. I was super responsible. I was always taking care of my siblings. I felt like an adult as a child. My parents were very young when they had me. So in a way, I felt like there was some of that going on where I had to parent my parents. So as a teenager, just my rebellion took the form of I'm not going to be that person anymore. And I'm just going to do what I want and find ways to escape these confines. It had to do with exploring my sexuality, with going out with my friends. I mean, we would at 14 or 15, we would go to clubs. It's crazy to think that at that age, you could be at a dance club and drinking and everything. But that's what we did. And we loved it. I was still very responsible in school. I don't know how I managed to do it, but even in college, I would go out and do all these things. But at the same time, I always would come home after going out and I would study and stay up until the wee hours or dawn. And then I did really well in school. But I had to have stimulation in these other fronts. And if I didn't have it, then I wasn't motivated to do a good job in school. I just remember just wanting to live life to the fullest. And that's what that meant to me, that I had to do everything. I think I wanted to be a bad girl, but because I'd been such a good girl before, I don't think I succeeded much at being that bad. I wanted to be really bad, but I wasn't. Yeah.
What's the fifth book on your list?
The fifth book on my list is a book that I discovered much later in life called La Nueva Novela, The New Novel by Juan Luis Martinez. This book is a total revelation. First, it's not a novel. It's a book of poems. I love the fact that it's called La Nueva Novela, the new novel. It begs the question, where's the novel? So it's kind of like the reverse of The Savage Detectives, in the sense that The Savage Detectives is a book about poetry in which poetry is absent. And Juan Luis Martinez, Chilean too, interesting, is a book in which the novel is absent. It's a book of poems. He had said at some point that he wanted to write a book that was quintessentially his, and yet a book for which he had written not a single word. So that's what this book is. It's a book of collage, appropriated text, a lot of images. It's almost like a scrapbook. It has instructions, a ton of instructions. It sometimes reads like a textbook. It opens with a section on all these absurd instructions for the reader that he actually took from an absurdist playwright, Jean Tardieu. and translated without really telling the reader that this is a translation of Tardieu's instructions. One is like, imagine a wall and imagine what's behind the wall, and then imagine what's behind that second wall, and then imagine what's behind that other wall. But they're not his. You wouldn't know it. And then he takes images of Marx, images of Lewis Carroll, Rimbaud, mathematical propositions. It's a super political book that was going to be published before the dictatorship, but then the dictatorship happened, the publication was canceled, and then he self-published it a number of years later. He then died youngish, and the book became an underground classic of Chilean literature, and it still to this day does not circulate in any edition but the one that he self-published. And it's interesting because part of his intervention, part of his politics, was to remove this book from official circulation. Not to get too technical here, but one of the things that Pinochet did in Chile against intellectuals was to impose a 20% tax on books. That tax is still operating in Chile. I visited Chile a number of years ago, and I realized that people were reading Bolaño in photocopies because they could not afford Bolaño's books. First, because they were printed in Spain, and then they had that tax. So the fact that Martinez managed to remove that book from official circulation, it only circulates underground. So if you want to get a copy, you need to know a bookseller who knows the widow, who then maybe will sell you a copy. It's really brilliant. I love that the politics of the book even pertains to the mode in which the book circulates. You know what I mean? Like it's a book that refuses to be co-opted still. On a very basic level, the other way in which it's political is that by your opening the book and reading it, you're already participating in its creation, because a lot of what it proposes is, as I said before, instructions and exercises for things that you have to do, which remain open. So you wonder, like, where's the poem? Is the poem the instruction, or is the poem the result of my interaction with the instruction and whatever I bring to it? So it's completely relational and participatory. And so the way it sidesteps authorship in traditional ways is radical for its appropriation, how it invites the reader to co-create it. It also, sadly, is not translated. That's one of the ways in which the book is also refusing commodification or co-option, is that they're not allowing people to translate it, which is tragic, but that in itself has a lot of potency. And he knew that.
You grew up speaking both Spanish and English. You speak both perfectly. You move very fluently between them. Yet in another interview, you've said that you're not really comfortable in either language. Why not? And what does that feel like?
I'm not comfortable in either language in the sense that I'm always aware of what I can't say in one language that I maybe could say in the other language, but I can't say it in this language. I'm aware of what I'm losing if I translate something when I'm speaking or when I'm writing. I wish I could write in both languages equally and maybe put them together, and that would feel more complete to a degree. I have a very heightened perception of when language is failing me. I have noticed that sometimes this dynamic is also just a fiction. So I may be saying something in English, and then all of a sudden I want to say something that I associate with Spanish, and I think I'd have an easier time saying it in Spanish. But then if I switch over to Spanish, I imagine that there's something that I can only say in English. And so, in other words, that thing that I'm trying to express is always out of reach. And this construct that I've devised as a bilingual person is that maybe the other language will help. But it's proven, experience has proven, that neither of them actually does that. And maybe that's what all of us who write experience constantly, which is that, yeah, working with language, we realize that sometimes it's not enough, which is what motivates a lot of what we do, actually, with language, just trying to reach this limit.
Which language do you dream in, or is it both?
It's so interesting. I normally will dream in the language in which I am living.
That is very interesting.
So right now, for instance, I'm here in the US, I'll dream in English. And then if I'm in Mexico and just speaking in Spanish primarily, I will dream in Spanish. If I dream in Spanish now, here, I might notice it. I might wake up going, oh, that was weird. I dreamt in Spanish.
I want to talk more about Spanish and English and your relationship to each of them. But before we do that, let's hear about the next book on your list, number 6.
Number 6 is Tender Buttons by Gertrude Stein. Not unlike Trilce by Vallejo, this is a book that allows for an infinite amount of readings. It is an inexhaustible book. I will never understand that book. And I will always be in awe of what Gertrude Stein is doing linguistically. It is astonishing to me. I sometimes feel that my use of language is so burdened by conventions, by linguistic conventions, by conventions dictating how things should be described, by the way parts of speech are supposed to behave. And the freedom that she manifests in this book in terms of the anti-mimetic qualities, right? Like it's representing something, but who knows what it's representing? It's both accessible because there are no words that one needs to look up in the book, which is what I love about Gertrude Stein, right? That her language is always radically accessible, and yet it's impenetrable at the same time. But I don't want to say that. That's why I stopped myself, because I didn't want to use the word impenetrable, because there's a presumptuousness that comes with impenetrability that points to obscure references. And that's not what's going on here. It is penetrable. Penetrable in the sense that it is pointing to these spaces and rooms that we can inhabit, because it's all terms that we have relationships with. But yet what they're depicting, it's just mind-boggling. I adore it. It's a gift that keeps on giving, this book.
She also provides titles that tell the reader, or at least provide reference points for the poems.
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because I was reading this book with a student last semester, and something happened in my reading of it that made me think of the so-called titles in a different way. And that is that the titles are maybe not titles, because if you look at them, they have a period at the end. They're sent off from the text, of course, and they do appear before a text. And therefore, you would think that what follows them is in direct relation with the thing designating them as belonging to, say, a table or butter. But because of those periods, what if they're just the things in this domestic environment that help orient yourself, that they're adjacent to the thing that they designate? They're just there in the room as well, and maybe are more discernible because they're set off. They're in isolation, but they're not qualifying what comes after. They're just among them.
Monica, as I was preparing for our conversation, I listened to another interview in which you read a poem you translated from Spanish to English in both languages. And it seemed to me that there was a distinct difference between the two versions. Is this something that you're aware of? And if so, how would you characterize the way that you read in Spanish as compared to English?
Can I ask you what you heard? How it sounded different?
For me, the Spanish version seemed more lyrical, more musical, perhaps. And it may just be that that's the nature of Spanish as compared to English. I don't mean to say that one version was better than the other, just that they were different.
I tend to agree with you, absolutely. But it might also be the way in which I read English. I think with Spanish, I have a more intimate relationship with it. So even though I claim, and I think it's true, that I'm comfortable with both languages, I do feel an allegiance to the qualities and the materiality of the Spanish language that's just very unfiltered. It's very raw. I feel very attached to it. And with English, it's much more cerebral and complicated and maybe aspirational. When I hear certain things in Spanish, or I read certain things in Spanish, in fact, I was going back to the Cortázar book, and when I read the translations, I just could not relate to them at all. And the text had no effect on me. And then I would go to the same piece in Spanish, and just the words that Cortázar uses, they just completely opened me up inside. It's just like a whole world of associations. Maybe that's what you're perceiving, my relationship to the language.
Yes, and I think that intimate is actually a much better word than lyrical to describe my sense of the Spanish reading as compared to the English one.
Yeah, it's almost as if I could locate my relationship to the language, my attachment to certain parts of language in different parts of my body, which also seems loaded, and perhaps it's really sappy. But I feel like right now I'm using my head a lot. And Spanish comes from my gut. It comes from below my head, for sure.
That's really interesting in light of your choice to primarily write in English now.
It is. I'm wondering why. What is it? Maybe I'm giving up something that I need for my writing to continue. It's quite possible. The Trump era, one of the things that it did, made me dislike English, not as a literary language, but it made me feel repulsion towards the way in which English is used in the public sphere now.
It sounds as if Spanish was used in a very similar way in your youth.
Yeah.
So it seems that any language can be co-opted.
So true. What a great point. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. What's happening now at the level of the way in which people talk about the things that concern all of us, the consequences are so serious. They've never felt more serious to me. So it's like no laughing matter anymore. How could you match the subversiveness of, say, Fox News and how they spin everything and take the very language of the left to use it against the left? It just feels like the degree to which this is happening makes play with that very same language kind of ineffectual and pointless, which is the reason why I go back to Stein and Vallejo, because maybe the solution is elsewhere in refusing to use language conventionally, period.
Monica, you knew as a child that you wanted to come to New York City, and you did this in 1993 when you began studying at Columbia University. What was your experience of New York when you arrived, and at what point did you know that you were going to stay?
The experience was one of complete exhilaration. It was a really good time to be in New York City. It was just possible to live in the city. It was also a gentrifying era and a lot of things were changing, but it seemed possible to live according to your own means, and whatever means you had would allow for a different lifestyle, but it didn't feel oppressive in any way. It just felt like there were so many possibilities. Early on, I had the luck of finding an apartment in the West Village when the meatpacking district had not been gentrified yet. There was this restaurant called Florent. It was open maybe all night, or maybe it was open until 3 or 4 in the morning. And it was just like an incredible cast of people. All kinds of people would go there. There was another place called Rio Mar. You would see cops and then sex workers and artists. I loved being in the city at the time. At what point did I know I was going to stay? I didn't know it really until I met Bruce, my husband, Bruce Pearson. When I met him and we started dating, and then it became clear that we were going to move in together, and then we did. I moved to Williamsburg. That was also a really great time to be in Williamsburg. People of his generation who had been there since the 80s maybe disagreed, because I moved to Williamsburg in the late 90s. And it was already gentrifying, but still there were all these artist-run spaces. There were experiments of all types happening everywhere, even with restaurants. There was this restaurant owned by artists as well called Osnoth's that had amazing food. It was just such a great place to be in at the time. And then it became what it became now. Yet once I moved to Williamsburg, I think it became clear that I was going to stay. Before that, I wasn't sure that I'd be able to sustain myself here. So it was all contingent upon jobs and opportunities and stuff. And then things would just keep opening up. And that's the thing that determined my staying. I also was very lucky because I had dual citizenship. So that was possible for me.
What's the 7th book on your list?
The 7th book is After Lorca by Jack Spicer. It's a book that I didn't become aware of until, I want to say, 10 years ago. And it's a perfect book. It's such a perfect book. And it's perfect for me because it has everything I'm interested in. It has poetry. It has a lot of fiction. It has Spanish. It has English. There's a ghost of the Spanish, in other words. The ghost of the Spanish being Spicer's translations of Lorca, which sometimes are excellent translations and sometimes are fictional translations of poems that Lorca never wrote. It's a book also that I keep going back to because it's like a Mobius strip. It's full of commentary around the unreliability of translation, the contentious and yet sometimes quite complex relationship of reciprocity between poetry and fiction, fact and fiction. It feels like a book that Borges would have loved, because of also the blurry boundaries between fact and fiction. When something real is called fiction, then the status of everything just becomes questionable. One of the things that Spicer says, well, Lorca says in his apocryphal introduction to the volume, Lorca says that the translations are horrible. And of course, that's Spicer being self-deprecating about his own translations. But the book contains one of the best translations of Lorca's great poem, Ode to Walt Whitman. It really is such an incredible translation, and Spicer must have known it, but when he's making a self-deprecating comment that appears to be fictional, but then is not true, so the complete twist between fact and fiction is just so marvelously done in this book. It really inspired part of what I do with Repetition 19 in terms of my multiple translations of a poem that I wrote in Spanish.
I wanted to ask you about another one of your poems now, Mariposa Negra, which is from your collection titled Four, and it's dedicated to the memory of Aura. Is that how you say her name?
Mm-hmm.
Aura Estrada. And the poem is a meditation on grief. A recurring theme is the struggle to understand the loss of a loved one and perhaps the ultimate impossibility of that. It was published almost 10 years ago, and I'm curious if time has changed the way you think about loss. Would a poem dedicated to Aura be different if you wrote it today?
That's a beautiful question. I did write that poem a few months after she had passed away. The loss that I was responding to was a very specific loss, the loss of my best friend. What I wasn't able to see at the time was what her loss represented for her. And now I can see that. In other words, I think I might have been kind of narrow-minded and perhaps somewhat self-involved in my grief. But now when I see what really was canceled was her opportunity to become someone else, to evolve, to have a life with all its implications. That's profound. And when I'm 70 years old, I will see it even differently, even more differently than now. Maybe if I wrote that poem now, it would not be radically different. It would just have this other layer.
There's an extraordinary line in that poem. You will try to put your finger on something absent, and in doing so, you will smudge it. It seems to me that that line conveys the absence of clarity, the impossibility even of clarity with regard to the mystery of life and death. And it makes me wonder if there are examples of times that you've reached for meaning, for understanding, only to find that as you do so, they get further away.
Yes, 100%. Yet I think there's something about the smudge that brings that loss closer. It's a paradox, isn't it? Because if the smudge isn't there, then what is lost and is out of reach can get sucked into oblivion and becomes invisible. And we don't even remember it. And that's the loss that's perhaps the most tragic. It's a loss that we're not even aware of. Whereas there's a type of loss that reminds us, is a constant reminder of the thing that is further out of reach, but the sense of loss is so close to us. The smudge kind of replaces the thing that was present. And I think that's something that literature can do really well. It can circumscribe the loss and make it very felt and immediate to us, and captures both the closeness and the abyss of the thing that cannot be attained. Whereas when something's already in the abyss and we can't even name it, then it's really gone forever.
Yeah, that's lovely. Time for your last book, number 8.
Number 8, Life, a User's Manual by Georges Perec. So it's funny because I wrote something that quoted this book and my editors insisted on placing a comma after life. Life, comma, a user's manual, which I think is very funny because he did not use a comma. I never wanted a comma in there. But then editors kept insisting that it was needed. So now there's editions with a comma. Classic editor getting granular here, right? A comma presupposes that you could look back and create a thing that would be the user's manual for life. But when there's no comma, you can't tell those two things apart. In other words, it's like this old Argentinian joke that you might have heard. It maybe doesn't translate, so forgive me if it's not funny. It goes like this. Experience is a comb that you're given when you have gone entirely bald.
As somebody who is entirely bald, that's great.
Right. So you have experience, and you have your comb, but you have no hair left. Your user's manual, your instructions for life are no longer applicable. Which is what happens to Bartle Booth, the character in Georges Perec's incredible novel, which is there for many reasons. Why is it on my list? Why did I think of it as a talismanic book? I hadn't thought of this. It's amazing the amount of things that I hadn't thought about in regards to this book that talking with you brings forth and allows me to articulate and discover. What I love about it in a way has to do with what we're just saying. Each chapter of this novel has been completely predetermined on the one hand by a set of constraints that Perec has come up with, dictating what should be in each chapter. And yet, despite the predetermination and the constraints, every chapter is completely surprising. And if you didn't know that Perec was following these rules, you would have absolutely no idea that there was anything dictating the contents of each chapter. You wouldn't be able to discern that. So that interplay between chance and surprise and the unexpected and the rules that create the framework for surprise to appear is something that's absolutely beautiful in this book. And then the futility of Bartle Booth's lifelong project of making these landscape paintings that then get turned into puzzles that then he reassembles and then become whole again. It's just completely futile. But it's a lot like what we do as artists. It really speaks to a lot of what I've been talking about, I realize.
One of the things that we've skirted around but haven't addressed head on yet is the fact that you've said that you're not a fan of the poem as epiphany. Why not? And what should be the ambition or endpoint of a poem for you?
I don't want to be the person determining what kind of epiphany people should have. I'm trying to figure things out. I haven't figured things out. I have not. Even as a writer, everything I begin, I feel like I'm back to square one. I'm a beginner. I'm a perpetual beginner. I don't know what I'm doing. I really don't know what I'm doing. To me, the ideology behind an epiphanic poem is that the poet is the seer, the visionary who will convey this wisdom to the readers. I feel like I'm just fumbling through like everybody else. So that's one of the reasons why I just cannot write that kind of poem. I don't like those poems. I like poems that are inexhaustible, poems that you keep coming back to and keep yielding new things, new experiences of language.
Might those new things not be epiphanies?
Maybe there should be a distinction between what I'm calling the epiphanic poem and an epiphany, because I actually do believe in epiphanies. But the epiphany can occur in any kind of poem. And in fact, the more epiphanic a poem is, the less the epiphany will actually appear. So a poem that wants to convey this wisdom on life in a didactic, predetermined way is probably the least equipped vehicle for that to actually happen. I just want to look up the word epiphany, the usually sudden manifestation or perception of the essential nature or meaning of something. And that's where I question that essential nature or meaning of something. And so in the epiphanic model, yes, there's always this notion that this is the essential truth, the fundamental truth.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think we've actually come full circle. We started off talking about multiplicity, and it seems to me that what you're saying now, your problem with the epiphanic model in poetry is that it insists on a single truth, whereas you believe that there are multiple truths. Is that right? Am I correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and even the poem itself can give you different truths at different times. So it's not only that the poem might mean many different things to different people, but that the poem itself, when it comes to one reader, might reveal a plurality of different things. And maybe it's not even about that. I really like this notion of, Asbury talks about this, how a poem captures the experience of experience. One thing I've noticed about the experience of experience is the sense of ongoingness, simultaneity. We're always shifting, moving. There's dynamism. We're alive. And so thought is unstoppable. And perceptions, if you're alive, are unstoppable. And so why can't the poem reflect that as opposed to a moment in your consciousness? Why can't the poem point to that ongoingness? Just like your question about the elegy for Auda, my friend, that poem keeps meaning different things because my experience of what life is keeps changing and evolving.
At the end of each interview, I ask my guests to read a selection from one of the books they've chosen. Monica, what are you going to read for us today?
I'm going to read you a translation of a poem of Vallejos, Trilce number 36. And this is my own translation. I can also read it in Spanish if you would like. I could read in Spanish and English. Richard, would you like me to do that?
Yeah, that would be lovely.
I will begin in Spanish. And perhaps also, this is my answer to the question about the epiphany. Poema 36. Pugnamos ensartarnos por un ojo de aguja. Enfrentados a las ganadas. Amoníacase casi el cuarto ángulo del círculo. Hembra se continúa el macho a raíz de probables senos y precisamente a raíz de cuanto no florece. Por ahí estás, Venus de Milo. Tú manqueas apenas pululando, entrañada en los brazos plenarios de la existencia, de esta existencia que todavía iza perenne imperfección. Venus de Milo, cuyo cercenado, increado brazo, revuélvese y trata de encodarse a través de verdeantes guijarros gagos, ortivos nautilos, aúnes que gatean recién, vísperas inmortales. Laceadora de inminencias, laceadora del paréntesis. Rehusad, y vosotros, a posar las plantas en la seguridad dupla de la armonía. Rehusad la simetría a buen seguro. Intervenir en el conflicto de puntas que se disputan en la más torionda de las justas, el salto por el ojo de la aguja. Tal siento ahora el meñique de más en la siniestra. Lo veo y creo, no debe serme, o por lo menos que está en sitio donde no debe. Y me inspira rabia y me azarea, y no hay cómo salir de él, sino haciendo la cuenta de que hoy es jueves. Ceded al nuevo impar, potente de orfandad. Trilce 36. We strive to go through a needle's eye at loggerheads, bent on winning. The circle's fourth angle almost ammonifies itself. The male going on female, due to probable breasts, and precisely due to that which won't bloom. Are you there, Venus of Milo? You're barely impaired, entrailed within the plenary arms of existence. Of this existence still hoisting perennial imperfection. Venus of Milo, whose severed, uncreated arm twists and tries to elbow itself through green and gurgling pebbles, rising nautili, yet that have just started crawling, immortal eaves. Lacer of the imminent, lacer of parentheses. Refuse, and you as well, to set foot on the twofold security of harmony. Refuse symmetry for sure. Intervene in the conflict of ends battling in the most heated of jousts to leap through the needle's eye. And so I feel my pinky as an add-on to my left hand. I see it and suppose it is not me, or at least that it is where it shouldn't be. And this enrages me and vexes me, and there's no way out except pretending that today is Thursday. Yield to the new odd, potent with orphanhood.
What a lovely reading. That's great. Monica, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been a real, real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Richard. I could speak with you all day. Thank you so much.
This has been Acts and Facts. I'm Richard Croft. My thanks to Charles Curtis for allowing me to use Captain Hume's Galliard by Tobias Hume as the theme music for this podcast.